So first of all, congratulations again for the prize.
Thank you.
How did you know if you knew that you made a breakthrough discovery?
In my opinion, the breakthrough came from asking the following question. When among the three labs now relevant, we were trying to figure out what is the gene like, the first clock gene, what is it like? But a gene just sitting there is worthless. It's got to do something. So we wanted to say, what are the products of the gene doing? Well, we described the products in New York and Boston, and the description, interestingly, gave us no insight. Sometimes you sequence the gene and you say, that product on paper looks like this, and therefore it's doing this. In the case of the first clock gene, no insight. In fact, misleading insights, which fucked up the literature for a few years, then got straightened out. But the key finding was not to describe the gene or the product. It was a woman in our lab at last made the first antibody that detected the protein coming from this gene. And she's, instead of just sacrificing the animal at random times to see if the antibody would stain, lead to staining of relevant cells and tissues, she said, I'm going to start sacrificing them systematically at different times of day and night. So she, working with, at the time, one of the relatively few excellent undergraduate researchers, whom I'll never forget, the woman, the postdoctoral was and is Kathy Sawicki. She was working with an excellent undergrad named Danielle Zayer, and together they found that the staining went up and down every day. And then we realized the following. It's almost an aphorism. When you mutate the gene, you change daily rhythms. But the generation of the product, in the normal case, defines a daily rhythm. That can't be a coincidence. There's got to be some causal connection there. And then we found that the first blush product, the RNA, DNA makes RNA, makes product, the RNA does the same thing. It goes up and down every day. Huge amplitude. Mike Young, for the second clock gene known in animals, he said, I got to ask that question for my gene. It's an obvious question, follow-up question. He found the same thing, the RNA and the protein from his gene, separate gene, another very important clock gene. The same thing. So many clock genes in many organisms were found to generate their product to define a daily molecular rhythm. That is true across all organisms. Sometimes the rhythm of the final product is not governed by generating the product. It's a so-called post-translational rhythm. But the level of the functional molecule goes up and down every day. That's the normal phenomenon. And so that we weren't just trying to figure out how the mutations affect the rhythm. We were saying the mutations also point to the gene. What is the gene about, and what is it doing normally? That's what biogenetics is all about. Starting with mutants often, sometimes starting with molecules, and then not trying to figure out what the variant, what the abnormal thing is about or like, but identifying via the mutation the normal gene. That is what genetics is all about, going back to Mendel, back into the 1800s. You're not just trying to identify variants. Variants point to the normal forms of the gene, and that's what biogenetics, this is what I call, it's my own term, nobody uses it, which is fine, studying biology, a biological phenomenon. There's 100 different kinds of biological phenomena studied genetically, molecularly, including rhythms. It's a subset of the overall some people who are involved in this prize-awarding org may remember that the third Nobel Prize given to Drosophila researchers, that was in the 1990s, was for biogenetics. Not the first two Nobel Prizes were about pure genetics, fruit flies, which had hugely significant for other organisms beyond fruit flies. The third Nobel Prize was for biogenetics. Three Drosophilists taking a genetic approach to study not rhythms but embryology. And they, I knew all three of them, personally, and I knew that they didn't know that they were doing anything significant when they started. But their work, they found these remarkable developmental genes, which turned out to have molecular relatives in all animals on the planet, way beyond fruit flies, which was horrifying to many. He said, my God, that's an insect, but mammals have the same genes functioning in analogous ways for mammalian development, including human development. So their work, which was very interesting fruit fly-wise in the 70s, 80s when it emerged, but later it was realized, my God, these guys were doing more than they realized. They were identifying genes genetically and molecularly, and then people in many other labs, scores of additional labs, took these molecular probes from the fruit fly and found, say, can I find a similar gene in a mouse? They'd expected not to find them, but there they were. And that's exactly what happened with rhythm genetics, too. This first clock gene cloned, the period gene, which you mentioned, immediately people did the obvious thing. Can I find a similar gene in a mammal? That was mindless. It was automatic without even thinking about it. For 12 years, they found nothing. And they said, therefore, there's no similar gene in mammals. And when I heard that from the people doing it and finding nothing, I said to myself, I don't believe you. I don't believe you're trying hard enough or you know what you're doing.
So you were convinced that you were right.
I was convinced. Well, but I didn't do anything about it. It was just a gadonkin experiment. But in 97, 12 years later, two labs, one in Texas in the U.S., the other in Tokyo, Japan, simultaneously found in a human and mouse molecular relatives of the fruit fly period gene. And that helped kickstart this enormous enterprise in mammalian chronomolecular genetics. They said, oh, my. And now all the clock factors, the key ones in flies, have molecular relatives in mammals. So the clock works, as Mike Young said, goes way back hundreds of millions of years, predating the divergence of invertebrates to vertebrates and mammals and flies. It's ancient, an ancient mechanism with very similar factors. The genes, these are not vaguely similar genes. They're bona fide evolutionary molecular, people call these orthologs. Genuine evolutionary relatives in flies vis-a-vis mammals, humans. This was surprising to some because they said, we can't find the molecular relatives. And this was before genomics. They couldn't do it just by looking at the computer. They had to do it by lab work, and they found nothing. But their failures were because they didn't try hard enough or they didn't know what they were doing because empirical reality, not rumor, published papers in 97 from two separate independent labs, both found molecular relatives of the first clock gene.
And still you got the prize in 2017.
Yeah, and because eventually I think, you know, like when the aforementioned developmental biogeneticists, their Nobel Prize-winning papers, so-called, was in 78 and 80. But by the mid-90s, it was recognized by many who hover around biology in general that those papers, 15, 17 years later, were regarded as hugely significant compared with how they were recognized at the time, which was interesting, new knowledge about insect development, and that was it. Well, later he said, my God, these people were finding more than they realized. And this has happened in the history of all science for centuries, that sometimes one's work becomes significant not just because it's realized to be significant as such, but people may or may not pick up on it and ask similar questions and extend the significance by their findings. So our rhythm genetic molecular clock became more significant than we would have ever guessed because people picked up on what we did. And that doesn't always happen, and it's not always warranted. So I give a tip of my hat to people working on lower organisms than flies and organisms higher than flies who made our work in context more significant than it was at the beginning and that we ever imagined it might be. So But we ourselves could have done nothing without predecessors, Drosophilus and Rhythm People, and many others. In the early days, there were very few people studying rhythms genetically, molecularly. It was ridiculed, even. That was good. That left us alone. If we were going to get nothing done, then who would have cared? And also the competition was minimal. But now, and this all goes back to this fellow named Konopka, who did a brave, this is starting in the late 1960s. I was there. I got to know him when he was doing his work. Very fortunate for me, because he was such a good biologist and person, both. And what he found was, somewhere in mind at all times was his amazing accomplishment. And what I wrote once, when he died 2 years ago in his obituary, I said, there are now thousands of researchers that don't realize it, and they don't need to realize it. They owe their living to that man. They can pay their mortgages and feed their children thanks to Ron Konopka. Because now this genetic molecular studies of rhythms across organisms, plants, animals, microbes, mammals, zebrafish, nematode, every imaginable organismal type, bacteria, it goes back to this guy who said maybe adding genetics might help. He didn't think it was going to be a cure-all. People claimed that we were saying it was going to crack the case, which we never did. They claimed that we said that, and therefore they said, you guys are assholes. And we said, yes, we're probably assholes, but that's not the reason. Furthermore, for to call us what you do, we're not going to quit. We still think it's worth doing, or at least fun to do. And so we owe everything to this man, who started in a gutsy manner in the fateful summer of 1968. I'll never forget it, because he was told before he started, don't do it. It won't work. It's too much work. But his boss, who was my boss, he said, don't do it. But he was such a minch, as we say, he never forbid anybody to do something, because he didn't care. He wasn't so anxious. He said, I want you to do something which will work and get me another paper in my next grant. He never worried about that. He said, don't do it. It's not a good idea. He said, but I'm not going to disallow you. If you really want to do it, go ahead and do it.
Which is good.
So it's good to have critics, but it's bad to have people who deny before it starts. And it was amazing that it worked. In fact, he had a great sense of humor. He thought he might have to go through, as I won't tell you that he did, thousands of tries to find the first mutant. He found it in the first summer out of 200. And he formulated what he called, it's in the literature, Konopka's first law, which is, and somebody said, what is that? And he said, and then he said, deadpanned, trying not to laugh, if you don't find it in the first 200, quit. And then they said, what's your second law? And he said, there is no second law. And so he was lucky. It was almost like the flies. This is silly, but I always said, the little flies, they said, if you're going to try this out with us, we're going to give you something in your first summer. Because it's gutsy for you to do what you're doing, because it shouldn't work. The a priori criticisms he got. In fact, when he found the mutants, this famous man, this is at Caltech, a world-famous man, a Nobel Prize winner, denied. He said those mutants couldn't exist. They did exist. He found them. This guy denied that they existed. He said, because it's a miracle for them to exist. That's how, if you read that paper's worth reading, because it's published in what I call a vanity journal for the general readership. It's understandable. It's very short. Konopka and Benzer, 71. You say, my God, this is incredible accomplishment. He found three mutants, one that had a fast clock, one that had a slow clock, and the other that had no clock. That's a miracle. And they're all in the same gene. And he said, if you guessed before you started what are the three types of mutants that could come out, well, maybe no mutants if he'd been unlucky. Those are the three types you'd predict. And there they were. And they were so amazing that their existence was denied by a professor of his in the same department. He said, no, those couldn't exist at all, let alone those three types. And Benzer tried to tell him, Well, this is Max Delbruck. You can look him up. He's a famed Nobel Prize winner, long dead, thank God. From 69 is when he won the Nobel Prize and became famous at Caltech and everywhere else the rest of his life. But he denied that the mutants... He, of course, said they could never exist before you start. But when they did exist, he denied their existence. That's how amazing was that paper.
And how do you explain this?
It's because if you try to initiate a genetic project for all kinds of reasons, studying many different phenomena, including rhythms, amongst many other, that you always find something. If you work hard enough and know what you're doing, if you know how to recognize a novel variant, this is historical. This, by the way, another Nobel Prize winner named Ed Lewis, who I already mentioned in the mid-90s, he figured out a way to treat flies with a chemical substance that jacks up the mutation rate. And all you have to do is put them in a bottle with tissue paper soaked in the low concentration of the poison, which is a mutagen. And when you do that, you increase the mutation rate so often, and that's how people start out. That's how we and Mike, so we start out to look for novel mutants. We induce them with the chemical that Ed Lewis figured out in the 60s. And so you can almost predict how this chemical reacts with DNA, that you're going to induce new mutations. And if you get a big enough denominator, as we said, you can't screen 10 strains. You've got to screen hundreds, usually more than 200. And every time, this goes back now decades, every time people have done this, with the proviso that they're treating with the chemical mutagen, they always find novel mutants. And it makes sense because it's such a powerful chemically interactor with DNA. And so it always works. The only times it doesn't work, I know the handful of times it doesn't work, and I know the people for whom it's failed, and I am aware of the fact that they never knew what they were doing or they didn't care much. But everybody who knows what they're doing and cares, like the other two Nobel Prize winners in 95, I was in their lab as a visitor when I'd barely heard of them, nobody else had heard of them. They were doing just that, treating the flies and screening for embryonic anomalies, developmental biogenetics. And I knew they hadn't done anything quite yet, and I knew that I said, you're going to find stuff. It may or may not be broadly interesting sooner or later. It may never be, but you're going to find novel mutants because you guys clearly know what you're doing. In fact, one of them, you should look her up. She's still a world-famous researcher, Jannie Nussline-Volhard, who now is heads of Max Planck Institute in Tübingen, I think, somewhere. Mm-hmm. But I could tell she was the meanest. She scared the shit out of me because when I visited, she sat me down to do some of the work. And it was for just a few hours. And therefore, I knew what they were doing. They were screening for novel developmental mutants, and they hadn't found very many quite yet. But I said to myself, you're going to find them, whether or not a visitor is pitching in for 3 hours. In fact, later, after her famous Nobel Prize-winning paper came out with her lab mate, Eric Weishaus, I saw her at a conference in Europe, and during one of the breaks, which is the only good thing about conferences, I said, Jannie, your and Eric's paper was terrific. You know, what a great, for fruit fly only at the time. And I said, but it really pissed me off. You didn't make me a co-author. And she said, oh, you only sorted the flies for 3 hours.
So, do you?
So, but I knew what I was doing because I was sitting down there because she ordered me to do and she was going to hit me if I didn't. All I'm to say is that I knew what they were doing genetically and biologically. Although I participated only for 3 hours out of months. But it worked. I said, one way or the other, this is going to work. Sure enough, this great paper, which turned out nobody knew in 1980, came out in Nature. It was going to be a Nobel Prize-winning paper, but it turned out to be, which was realized 15 years later. Its significance sunk in. Took more than a dozen years later.
We'll have to finish soon, but I would like to ask you one more question.
Sure.
Do you consider yourself a successful scientist? How do you define
successful? I was successful for two main reasons. One is that I was imbued with enthusiasm and motivation to do genetics research when I was a baby in college, starting in college. I had terrific mentors. These don't exist anymore, but they did in the 60s and 70s. But then I said, so I was encouraged by people who were above me. And then I said, well, I appreciate the encouragement. And you say that maybe I might be good at it. I said, I don't know if I am, but I appreciate the encouragement and the support. And then I realized, aside from that, that I got to go to work every day, 7 days a week for 35, 40 years, and do something I liked to do. And they paid me a little. And it was salary. I wasn't punching a time clock. Like many workers all over the world, the boss says, you come to work tomorrow this time. If you don't, psh. So I got to go to work and do something I liked to do. I didn't think it was never necessarily going to work, but I said it's worth doing. It may not amount to anything. You know, I hope to publish something over my career, but I realize people don't realize this. I searched the biological literature once a week for 35 years with a database. There are 5,000 papers that come out every week. You know how many are cited? 5% of biological papers are cited once.
That means that
95% are there, and they may indeed advance knowledge, but nobody notices. Yeah. But the literature is forever. And at some point, many of these old papers that nobody pays any attention to at the time can be retrieved. And so that was, I said, I want to make publishable findings and publish them and hope that, A, some journal will say, all right, we'll publish this. It may not be interesting, but it's a little bit informative. And it looks like it's thorough or something. And I said, then maybe, or maybe not, usually the latter, maybe somebody will notice. Occasionally. But in our case, we were lucky to study rhythms because rhythms are interesting.
And is the Nobel Prize the highest measure of the success?
No, it's strange because Mike Young, Michael Rausbusch, and I started receiving prizes in 2009. This is the seventh. But the Nobel Prize is more salient than all the others. When we received these previous prizes, nobody noticed, which is understandable. Everybody is noticing this prize. I think my great satisfaction was to do something I like to do and I thought was possibly, possibly worth doing. Furthermore, I was able to get grant support for decades, which is almost impossible now. I'm glad I'm old and retired because if I was starting, I would never recommend to a young, I said, don't do it. You'll do all this education and training and apprenticeship. And then you won't get any money, even though you deserve money. The United States is anti-science. This is numerical. They're reducing support for science as the number of scientists increase.
Europe the same, so.
Well, but I'm not saying that Europe is different, but I'm saying if it's true anywhere, it's bad wherever it is. And if it's multiple countries, even worse.